against the Somerset School District. Rusbold, this is not a time to be sitting.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Rusbold, and I am the attorney for the Somerset School District. This matter was before the court approximately 2.5 years ago, and since then has returned to be tried. And the reason why we're back here today is to appeal the denial of a Rule 50 motion. We ask the court to reverse the trial court on two areas. One, that there was no legally sufficient evidentiary basis for a reasonable jury to find that the plaintiff was a qualified individual with an employee with a disability.
You mean there was no evidence that she was qualified?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
There was no evidence that she was qualified with some help?
That is our position, Your Honor, and I would be happy to elaborate on that.
Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, the only two qualified witnesses that testified on that question were her doctors, her therapist, psychologist, Dr. Erickson, her family practitioner, Dr. Erickson. Dr. Erickson testified that between October 18th, which is when she went on leave, and January 1st of the following year, Mrs. Ekstrand was substantially limited in her ability to think, learn, concentrate, and sleep. She was basically curled up in a fetal position in her bed on many days.
Did
she was
say
not
why?
Functioning.
They say why?
Because of she had suffered a severe depressive episode on or about October 17th or 18th. Dr. Potek, her family practitioner, testified that to a reasonable degree of medical probability, Ms. Ekstrand was not capable of teaching elementary school from October 18th until the end of the school year or the beginning of the next school year. More specifically, Your Honor, with respect to your question, is what did those two medical experts testify with respect to what she could have done with an accommodation? And that is one of the keys to this case.
It is the key to the case.
And what Dr. Erickson said with respect to that was, and she was asked a series of questions which were distinguished from one from the other only by the time periods. On direct examination, had Somerset School District agreed to provide Renee Ekstrand with a room with natural light after October 18th, but before the beginning of November of 2005, could she have returned to work and performed the functions of her job as a teacher on the anticipated return date of January 2006? She was then asked the same question with respect to November, gave the same answer, which was, yes, she could come back in January of 2006, or there was a likelihood or possibility of that. The question was phrased, could have. The same question was asked for December. Dr. Erickson broke it down into halves, said she could have if the assurance had been given the first half of December, but not the second half. Later in the trial, she was asked whether or not
my
she could have returned.
My question is, there sufficient evidence at all to go to the jury to indicate that they could make a ruling that at the time she was denied the release she sought, she could have been a functional member of the faculty?
The answer to that question, Your Honor, is no. And the reason
flat
why...
Flat out no?
Excuse me?
Flat out no.
Yes.
When the trial judge said there was such evidence, the trial judge was in error.
Actually, what the trial judge did with respect to qualifications was not to really assess the evidence that was given by the two treaters, but instead to look to the testimony of Ms. Ekstrand instead, and placed heavily based the trial court's decision on the plaintiff's own testimony that she was willing and desirous of returning to school.
And the doctors had said that, given the accommodation, she could have.
Dr. Erickson said that given the assurance of an accommodation, she could have returned some months
later.
That's
what I said.
Yes. And I do draw that distinction. But I would add to that one other thing, Your Honor, and that is that this was trial testimony. This is something that
the
school district had no
question of fact.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
That weighs the question of fact, the issue put out.
No, I think
it's not a question of fact, it's a question of law.
I think it goes to a question, it's a question of fact, but it goes to the question of knowledge. And that's the other basis for the district's challenge to the Rule 50 denial. That at the time the district did not have any knowledge of the medical necessity of that accommodation.
I thought that was taken care of by the jury verdict.
Well, our position on that, Your Honor, would be that the jury did not have sufficient evidentiary basis on which to find that the district had knowledge. And what was lacking in the district's knowledge, Your Honor, was that at the time, and Ms. Ekstrand is out on leave, and
she testified she gave them notice. She testified she gave the notice to two people. Am I correct?
That she, excuse me, she gave notice of
she
what?
She gave notice that they knew, the school people knew, or should have known, that she was in need of some help, and the help was simply to give her what she asked for.
Well, I would reckon back, Your Honor, to this court's earlier ruling
I'm fairly familiar with it.
You wrote it, Your Honor, and I would certainly defer to you on that, but this court did hold that the comments or the discussions between Ms. Ekstrand and the principal were but her own conclusory remarks and did not provide the requisite medical basis for the requested accommodation.
It went back down. The jury had more than that. They had some predicate for their decision. They had testimony of the doctors that you've just described very carefully.
But the doctors have testified, and the record shows that the doctors testified, that she was not capable of returning to school at any given time, but only that in Dr. Erickson's testimony was, as I described, that if you gave her the assurance on some particular day, there was a likelihood or a possibility that she would be able to return to school at some future day. But the district didn't know that. The district didn't know while she was on leave that a doctor had the opinion that it would be somehow therapeutic or helpful to her recovery. And there is no evidence of that. There is absolutely no evidence of any doctor at any time telling the district while Ms. Ekstrand was on leave that if you tell her that she is...
Are we talking about Rosberg saying he didn't know?
Yes.
Didn't he? There's no question she's talked about her seasonal affective disorder. She talked about the fact she needs natural light. You know it, Benda died. It's your testimony. Had you known about it, you would have seen she got it, right? I would have been able to make the connection. But on October 24th, you didn't? Did you know? I read it and I didn't see it. Did you call Renee and ask for clarification? I did not. Did you call Dr. Erickson to offer me the source of information for you? I did not. Now, why didn't he know?
Your Honor, I think you have to realize that the last time that Mr. Rosberg had seen Renee Ekstrand was on November 14th when she was in his office.
I'm talking
and
about
she
whether
was,
there was sufficient evidence for the jury to determine that she would have been capable of going back to work had they accommodated her.
And I would submit to the court, and it is our position that the answer to that question is no.
There you go.
I mean, that when she's...
So you think it was entirely unwarranted for us to have remanded for trial on that very issue?
On the issue of qualification?
Based on the summary judgment record. That's the issue we sent back for trial.
The issue of
your argument strikes me as a rather belated attack on our earlier decision.
If it sounds that way, it is not intended that way, and and I'm not understanding how it would be interpreted that way, Your Honor. Are we speaking of the qualifications question?
We sent back for trial this very question. And what you're saying is we shouldn't have done that on the record as it then existed. We should have affirmed the summary judgment for the school district.
The qualifications issue.
Yes.
And at the time this matter was before this court previously, the court found that there was a genuine issue of material fact with respect to whether or not she was a qualified individual.
An issue of material fact is genuine as a matter of federal procedural law when the evidence would permit a jury to find either way. And you're telling us that the evidence doesn't permit a jury to find either way.
Oh, at the time it was before this court, there's no question, and I do not challenge this court's finding, that there was a genuine issue of material fact. We went back. We tried that case.
And you lost.
What I'm saying here today is that the evidence does not sustain the jury's finding and that the trial court should have granted the ruling.
As a matter of federal procedural law, it is the same question.
But we bring a new set of facts, a more complete set of facts to this court.
Unless evidence that previously favored the plaintiff vanished, that evidence was enough to support a jury verdict in the plaintiff's favor. That's already been determined. And that's the Rule 56 question and the Rule 50 question, as a matter of federal procedural law, are the same question.
Except, Your Honor, that we now have the advantage of a full trial.
Yes, and the jury ruled against you on precisely the issue you're
I understand that. The trial court ruled against me.
You're in your rebuttal, sir. You can do it if you want to, but I just wanted to call your attention to it. The white light is on.
That means I have...
You're into your rebuttal.
I thought, well, then I'm misunderstanding my lights.
You left yourself 5 minutes rebuttal, didn't you?
Okay. Well, then I will wait.
5 minutes?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No.
I misunderstood the lighting system.
No. Well, that was explained before you came in, too, so there you go.
Thank you.
Ms. Skinner.
May it please the Court. I first want to offer my condolences for the loss of your friend and colleague, Judge Evans, who was part of this panel earlier. I've heard great things about him as a person, in addition to being an awesome jurist. And the only thing I can say is that I didn't agree with his concurring opinion, and I think if he knew Renee Ekstrand, he wouldn't have agreed with it either. The drawback to being appellate judges is you don't get to meet the people. You don't get to really know the people that are involved in this. And what the jury got to hear about Renee Ekstrand is that she was an absolutely devoted educator. All she cared about is teaching. And for her...
Counsel, if you would address the relevant issues.
Yeah. Sure.
This is not about her dedication.
Okay. Sorry.
It's about her qualifications to teach.
Okay. So the problem with the defense argument is that they ignore the definition of a qualified individual with a disability. The definition includes with or without accommodation. Yes, we put in testimony from her treatment providers that she was substantially limited in abilities to think, concentrate, work. But then we also put in evidence, and her treatment providers both testified that had she been accommodated, had she been given a room with natural light, she would have been able to perform her duties. And Renee Ekstrand testified to that as well. None of that testimony was even refuted. So frankly, I don't know why we're here on that issue.
That's the only issue we're here.
So,
other than damages itself.
So Dr. Erickson's testimony was not even questioned. That she was asked whether had Renee Ekstrand been given a room early on in the situation when she first asked for it, she wouldn't have had a mental meltdown, frankly. But right before she went on leave, she again asked for a room, which room was available empty and would have been free to give to Renee Ekstrand, but for some reason that no one has ever been able to explain, the answer was no. She's not going to be given that room. And she then went on leave, and after going on leave, She wrote a letter to the superintendent because she'd been asking the principal four or five times for this room, and the principal was saying no. And so the superintendent was the next best thing. She went to him. She wrote a letter. She explained everything, how this had happened, how come she had to take a medical leave because of the denial of an accommodation. And he didn't answer the letter. She asked in that letter, could she please have a room with natural light? So then she set up a meeting with him. And she sat in his office and told him how much she wanted to be back at school, how much she wanted to teach, and could she please have a room with natural light. Other teachers had actually offered their rooms, more than one teacher. And there was an empty room that sat empty. And the school district's excuse for not giving her the empty room was, well, we might add a third grade section sometime. And Renee said, well, what if you do decide to add that section, couldn't I have the room now? And if the section is added, they could have that room. No, that would be a short-term solution to a long-term problem, and we would just have to move you next year. That tells me that an employer is not interested in accommodating at all when they give that kind of answer. So as far as Renee being a qualified individual with a disability, there isn't any real doubt. There's no testimony refuting the testimony that she was, in fact, a qualified individual with a disability. And had they given her a room in October, she wouldn't have had to take a leave. If they'd given her a room in November, she would have been back. The testimony was she probably would have been back sooner than January had they given her that room in November when she asked for it from Superintendent Rosberg on November 14th when she met with him. She testified that she would have probably come back the next day. Her treatment provider, Dr. Erickson, testified that she would have come back for sure by the January 18th date, but probably sooner. Dr. Potek is her medical provider, and he testified that had the accommodation been given to her early in the process, he said it might have made a difference in her ability to return to work. But the clear testimony was from her psychologist that she would have been able to return to work, and Renee Ekstrand testified that she would have been able to return to work. Essentially, she did everything she could first to avoid being put into the room that she knew was going to be a problem. And actually there was testimony that wasn't before this court earlier about the knowledge of the school district. Two things that weren't before this court earlier is a conversation that Renee Ekstrand had with her principal in June of 2005 before she was placed in the room, when she told her principal, I don't want to be placed in that room. I suffer from seasonal affective disorder. And I was in a room like this before, and it was a big problem for me. I had to end up seeking medical intervention, and I was placed on medication. So that information was given to the principal in June of 2005, and the principal testified at trial that she knew about seasonal affective disorder. So the concern among the panel last go-around is what the school district knew, whether they understood the medical necessity of the need for her accommodation. And the testimony at trial was that there wasn't any real question that they knew. She told her principal that she'd had a situation in the past that required medical intervention and medication. And the school principal admitted that she knew about seasonal affective disorder and the relationship between seasonal affective disorder and natural light. And then she changed it to all spectrum light. But in essence, the principal had a number of issues that the jury was entitled to discredit her testimony altogether. It sounded, the testimony, she first said, yes, she knew about natural light, and then she kind of backed off and said, oh, no, I mean all spectrum light. But, in fact, she knew what seasonal affective disorder was. She knew the relationship between the disease and needing light and did nothing about it. And the problem that I have with the school district's response was once an employee makes known a disability and asks for an accommodation, the law in this circuit is the employer then has an obligation to either grant the accommodation, or if there's any question about the desired accommodation, the nature of the illness, then the employer has the obligation to seek clarification. That's the law in this circuit, and that is not what happened in this case. There was never any kind of effort on the part of the school district to seek clarification of any kind. And, in fact, the evidence showed that the principal was telling the business manager that she's not going to allow Renee to switch rooms because she doesn't have a doctor's note. She never asked for a doctor's note. Renee had no idea that the school district wanted a doctor's note because they never once asked her. They never sat down with her. They never initiated any kind of interactive process, which is also required in this case. And that's why the whole issue of notice even came up. The school district has never once, in all of the lower court issues, it has never come up that they didn't understand the medical necessity of the desired accommodation. And if, in fact, they had a question about the medical necessity, it's their burden to ask Renee to say, I don't understand what you need here. Tell me what you need. If necessary, give me a note from your doctor saying what you need because I don't understand. The fact is they never asked for that because they understood. They knew. And I think the underlying issue of why they wouldn't give her the room has to do with, you know, we're not in Chicago or Madison or the Twin Cities. We're in Somerset, Wisconsin, small town. And I think there was a lot of evidence, of the decision maker, Randy Rosberg's bias against mental health disabilities. Perhaps he didn't understand them. Perhaps he didn't have experience with them. But he didn't seem to want to give her the time of day because she had a mental health disability as opposed to a physical disability. And that was evidenced by the testimony that came in with regard to a teacher who was pregnant and needed leave at the same time that Renee was on leave. Mr. Rosberg opened the sick leave bank for the pregnant employee immediately and then, of course, had to do so for Renee, but had earlier denied that very thing. There was testimony that the policy of the district isn't to ask teachers on leave for their keys and ID badge, but in fact they did just for Renee. There was an email that he sent to his office people asking if Renee's leave was the only one for mental illness. So the jury there was plenty of evidence for the jury to reach the decision that Renee was a qualified individual with a disability. There was plenty of evidence for them to decide not to believe anything that Randy Rosberg or the principal, Ms. Wood, said because there was a lot of evidence that weighed against their credibility, and the jury was entitled to disbelieve anything they wanted to from either of those two decision makers. The testimony about her being qualified individual with or without accommodation was unrefuted. So as far as why the district appealed this case, frankly, I don't have any idea. This wasn't even close.
Yeah, people are always shocked when somebody opposes their point of view.
I have nothing further, unless you have questions.
It doesn't look like it. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Rushbolt?
How much time do I have left?
You have to keep track of your own time, counsel. That, too, is in the advice given to counsel before oral argument.
My apologies. There was no bias in this case. There may have been some lack of appreciation. There may have been some lack of understanding. But that lack of appreciation and understanding really goes to the concerns that were raised by this court in its initial opinion that with the non-obvious aspects of a mental disability, employees must make employers aware of those non-obvious medically necessary accommodations, and that didn't happen in this case. It didn't happen in the conversations between Renee Ekstrand and her principal, and that's what this court found. It didn't happen in the only conversation that took place between the two of them that was not before this court. It was not made up by any knowledge on the part of Principal Wood. In fact, when you look at the exact exchange in that testimony, it is clear that she understood natural light or the need for Renee Ekstrand to have light was a full-spectrum lighting, which she had, and that conversation was corroborated entirely by the testimony of Jan Carlson. That was her understanding. With respect to the knowledge of Mr. Rosberg, he only knew Ms. Ekstrand from two basic interactions. One was the letter of October 24th, and the other was when she was in his office on November 14th of 2005. And at that time, she was crying uncontrollably. She was in no condition to come back to work. There was no reason. She was on a 3-month leave of absence, and there was no reason why he should think otherwise, other than to wait for her return to school. and there was no reason or there was no basis for any of the people at the school district to have any awareness, any inkling, that if they were to have called her up and said, "Oh, Renee, if you come back in January, we just want to let you know that you'll have a room." In fact, their lack of appreciation for that, which is well-founded, is actually found in a conversation that they testified to, where sometime in November and December, the two of them spoke about the fact that when Renee comes back to school, we will have a room for her with inside. Now, they didn't call her. Why didn't they call her to tell her that? Not because they had something to any kind of vindictive attitude toward Renee Ekstrand. She was a good and a well-respected teacher.
All the of that information was before the jury, was it not?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was, Your Honor. And lastly, to state what is, I think, well laid out in our briefing, and that is this. Mr. Rosberg and Ms. Wood never, ever saw that letter, the letter of November 28th, until well after this litigation had begun. It went to the workers' comp carrier, and it went to the workers' comp person at the school district, but it never went to the two individuals who were involved in these requests.
And what is the legal significance of that?
I think the legal significance of that, Your Honor, is knowledge. Whether or not the decision makers had...
I don't get it. You mean the school district, through its internal method of rooting documents, can root documents in a way to keep critical decision makers ignorant and then plead ignorance as a defense in the ensuing litigation?
If that was what was going on, I would agree with you entirely, Your Honor. If they routed it in...
You just told us they sent the documents to the workers' compensation people rather than... the principal.
In the normal course of events, not out of any negative or any kind of ill-motivated reasons.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.